is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 57 was recorded on April 6th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Juliette has a very impressive resume, including hedge fund and proprietary trading positions for some very prominent firms. These days, she runs a highly respected boutique institutional macro advisory firm, whose clients include some of today's most successful portfolio managers. Juliette's research notes are normally available only to her institutional clients, and since they're paying tens of thousands of dollars a year for that service, Juliette obviously cannot share fresh research with our Macro Voices listeners. But we have a special treat for you this week, as Juliette was kind enough to allow us to share a sample research note, which is now about 10 days old, meaning that her institutional clients already have their trades on and won't be offended if she shares it with you. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. Now, if you're not already registered, you're certainly welcome to register in order to get the download, and you can find instructions for doing so next to Juliette's picture on our homepage. However, at Juliette's request, we're asking our friends at Zero Hedge and other partners not to republish this one on the internet, as Juliette has stipulated that it be made only available to registered Macro Voices listeners.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, let's talk about this S&P 500. It's been a crazy 48 hours. We started off with a breakout on the S&P 500 heading up to the 2370 area. Then the FOMC minutes came out, 30-point plunge in just a matter of hours. And now we find ourselves retracing that, closing around this 2353 area. What's your feeling about the S&P 500 here?
Well, as you say, it's been a roller coaster week, and you know this is getting comical to me. Let's talk about up to the FOMC minutes coming out. You know, 2375, Patrick, I think was the high print on the E-mini futures, almost back up to the area of new all-time highs. And I think that this market continues to shrug off a lot of bad news. Then, of course, the big news from the FOMC was really two things. One was that several members commented that stocks are very highly priced. Okay, so we've got the FOMC warning us that the market is overvalued, and then the Fed saying that they're going to begin shrinking their balance sheet this year. Now, if you're of my opinion, which is that this entire crazy rally since 2009 has been primarily fueled by excess liquidity courtesy of the Fed, and they just told you they're going to start mopping up that liquidity, that cannot possibly be good for markets. And it's no surprise at all that we saw that reaction. What does blow my mind, though, is a lot of people, including professionals who want to know better, said that the market crashed on the news. Look, that was a 1.47% intraday move to the downside on the back of the Fed telling us that the stock market is overvalued and they're going to start mopping up liquidity. If you want to know what a crash looks like, it's like 20% plus intraday move like we had in October of 87. A 1.5% move that's retraced within 24 hours, not fully retraced, but more than halfway retraced within 24 hours is not a crash, folks. So the fact that people call this a crash to me is just an indication of how much complacency exists in this market. I think there should have been a much bigger and longer lasting sell-off because this market was built entirely on Fed liquidity. They're taking away the punch bowl, folks, and they're telling us that clearly. And the market reacted appropriately for all of a couple of hours, and now it's retraced. So bull markets, how do they end? They end with exactly this sort of senseless euphoria where people are ignoring bad news, turning it into good news. And usually what happens is it goes on much longer than skeptics like me think is possible. So how long does it take before the bottom falls out of this market? I don't know. Maybe we're still headed towards new all-time highs above 2,400. I don't know. But if we do, I'm definitely going to start accumulating puts because this can't go on forever. And I would say definitely, though, that if I do start accumulating puts, it would probably be something like the December expiry because you never know how long it's going to take.
Well, absolutely. And let's take a look at that U.S. dollar index next. I mean, we have now, what is it, 5 consecutive days closing above the 100 handle, just staying in this tight little range. What do you think is next for the U.S. dollar here?
Well, as our regular listeners know, I was stopped out of my long trade on the move below 99 last week, and I'm still out. I haven't re-entered the position. I don't plan to right away. We are bouncing back above 100, but it looks like that bounce is starting to maybe run out of steam. I do still have a bullish long-term view on the dollar index, but honestly, my conviction, at least in the short term, is weakening. Julian Brigden's comments last week really resonated with me. You know, to sit out a couple of dances on this long dollar trade. I hope I don't miss the boat on this, but I won't be surprised if we do break what looks like it could even be a head and shoulders pattern, short-term head and shoulders pattern forming. There's so much long interest in the dollar that if that all unwinds quickly, you could see a pretty pronounced move, and I would use that as an opportunity to get back into the long trade with better location, maybe if we can get back in the mid-90s somewhere. But for now, I'm going to sit on the sidelines.
Well, you know, just to comment on that, obviously the euro is a major component within that dollar index. And with the French elections just a few weeks away, it'll be very interesting to see whether that develops as the catalyst for the next major currency move, right? Now, I want to move on to crude oil. Now, after that very sharp sell-off, which you called so well, we've now seen many days of retracing. We're back above the 51 level on crude oil. What's your feeling here about oil?
Well, we've had another roller coaster week in oil, but where the stock market roller coaster, the top of the roller coaster was centered around the FOMC statement, the oil was centered around the inventory report from the EIA, which came out Wednesday morning at 10:30. So we started out the week with everybody expecting a drawdown in crude oil inventories and just wanting to tell themselves this narrative about how that means that the OPEC cuts are rebalancing the market and it's all up and away for here and everything's going to be great and so forth. We got almost to 52 before the inventory data even came out. So there's a lot of speculation that there was going to be a bullish inventory report. And yeah, that $52 or 51.70 something, whatever it topped at, that was a full 10% bounce off of 47, which is where the bottom print was, at least in the short term, our recent cycle low. So it was a bigger bounce than I expected. Then we got the inventory report, a pretty large build, crude oil nationally, 1.6 million barrel build. Cushing, Oklahoma, which is, of course, critical because it's the settlement location for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract, 1.4 million barrel build on inventories. Bullish data. Now, we did have drawdowns in distillates, but much, much smaller than expected. Gasoline drawing down only 618,000 barrels, distillates 536,000 barrels. So, you know, just over a 500,000 barrels each in the face of expectations of 2 million plus. Now, this sharp sell-off that commenced immediately on that news is exactly what should have happened. I thought that perhaps that would be the catalyst for reality to set back in and for people to stop trying to tell themselves this narrative that OPEC's going to solve everything with this meaningless production cut. Again, I still think that we ought to be headed for $45, if not lower, based on fundamentals, at least in my opinion. But you know what? That, similar to the stock market sell-off, you know, the sell-off that was based on very solid bearish data lasted a few hours, and 24 hours later, we're retracing entirely all of that move, and we're back up pushing high 51s, almost 52 on Thursday afternoon. So we're in a great big bounce because everybody is telling themselves a story that they want to hear, and they're ignoring hard data. So hard facts don't seem to be working for more than a few hours in either the stock market or the oil market this week, but I think both of them ought to be moving lower. We also got an excellent listener question about the term structure of crude oil futures. Let's save that, though, for after the feature interview.
All right, that sounds like a plan, Eric. So, but let's move on to actually gold, because gold for now several weeks has tested this 1260 level on the upside, keep bumping its head there. What's your feeling on gold? Do you think it's going to break out here?
Well, I still think it may, because although you're right, it keeps bumping its head on 1260, it seems to be holding on to 1250 pretty nicely. Each time we've had a move below 1250, it recovers pretty quickly. So we've been a little bit range-bound between 1250 and 1260. I think this may be just a brief consolidation and a continuation pattern before it goes higher, but I still think the big story is in the dollar index. If we were to see that head and shoulders pattern get confirmed, dollar index breaks down, then I think gold almost has to go very, very quickly to the upside. On the other hand, if my actual fundamental view, which is bullish on the dollar index, proves right sooner than I expect that it might happen, then that could be bad news and a headwind for gold. So I'm waiting to see what happens here.
So let's touch on bonds here, Eric. We were holding that 240 level, and then last week we saw a quick break, and now we're trading well below the 240 handle, testing down towards 230. What's your thinking here on bonds?
Well, I think that we're in a correction that probably has a few months to play out. Is it going to go below 2.25? I think it probably will. If we actually get a recession, probably 2% or lower. Juliet DeClercq, our feature interview guest, has been just nailing the fixed income calls. When we hit 2.60 recently, a few weeks ago, she sent out a note that I had a courtesy copy of to her subscribers saying, okay, this is it. It's time to go long treasuries. Last week when she sent us the note that our listeners received in this week's research roundup, she said add to that position. At that point, we were at 2.45, so she already had a solid profit built in, and of course, it's just continued to go in her direction. So let's listen to what Juliet has to say about fixed income in the feature interview.
All right. Well, thanks for that market update, Eric. Now, Juliet DeClercq is the founder of JDI Research and is a very highly respected macro analyst known for her detailed graphs and charts. So be sure to get the download. There are two files. One is a sample research note titled Red String of Fate Links the U.S. to China. And the other is a PDF containing three additional charts Juliet sent to us to support her interview. If you do not have access to the chart book, the instructions are on the macrovoices.com website in the description for this podcast next to her picture. Eric's interview with Juliet is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Juliet DeClercq, founder of JDI Research, a boutique institutional advisory service that advises some of today's most successful portfolio managers. Juliet, we originally had you scheduled for an interview a couple of weeks ago. In advance of that, you sent us a sample research note in which you expressed a bearish view on the U.S. dollar index, a bullish view on U.S. 10-year treasuries, which at the time were yielding 2.60, and a rather outspoken opinion that the upcoming FOMC meeting, which of course had not happened yet at that point, would not produce a hawkish surprise as a lot of people were thinking. Now, quite frankly, Juliet, I was long dollar index futures on the day that I received that note. And honestly, I looked at 102.80-something and rising rapidly when I received your note. And I thought, what the heck is this lady talking about? Well, of course, you nailed all three of those calls perfectly. I wound up being stopped out of that trade at a 98 handle. So I wish I had followed your advice a bit sooner. But you actually, instead of coming into that interview gloating, you asked us to reschedule the interview because at that point, after the FOMC meeting happened, you felt like, okay, it's no longer actionable. You wanted to give our listeners something actionable. So we shuffled the schedule a little bit, and we've brought you back now when you were able to give us a new research note. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got all those calls right. But let's move on to your more recent work. Obviously, out of respect for your paying subscribers, we can't share fresh research with our audience. But you were kind enough to share with us a research note from about 10 days ago titled Red String of Fate Ties U.S. to China, which you penned back on March 27th, and which our listeners can find a link to in their research roundup email. Or if you're not registered yet, just look for instructions on how to get registered next to Juliet's picture on our website. You recommended adding to the 10-year long that you opened at 2.60. At that point, the 10-year was down to 2.45. Today, it's around 2.33. So you're just nailing all of these calls. Why don't we start with the additional charts that you sent us, which we've packaged in a separate PDF. That download link is also in the Research Roundup email. And then get into this research note. So take it away.
Hey, so good afternoon, morning, evening, everyone from sunny London. I invite you all to read the particular report that Eric just mentioned and that my clients have agreed to share with you. This time, again, the trades I recommended have run a little faster than I could communicate it to you, but the report is still very relevant and a good medium-term trading roadmap. The reference to China is in the title is a wink to the fact that the US economy cannot possibly be analyzed without taking into account the global outlook in the last two decades. Because my trade recommendations have now moved a lot in the right direction, I'd like to hopefully offer some value to you by explaining the background of the way I'm thinking. Firstly, I think it's important to remember that the US has not only invited but invented globalization, and this is now at the roots of today's challenges. The current global tax system in the US, which encourages tax inversion and which Trump despises so much, was in fact devised to colonize foreign workforces and bring down consumer inflation from the 80s. You will see on the first chart called Globalization, the Good News, that this particular policy has worked wonders. The issue is that short-term gains in the form of higher profits and lower consumer prices came at the price of long-term pain for the average worker. You will see on the second chart that the flip side of the globalization of the workforce means that workers lost bargaining power and that wage share as a percentage of gross domestic income collapsed whilst inequalities increased dramatically. On the third chart, you can see that the initial consumer and corporate gains quickly became worker pain, and inequalities became more acute. GDP per capita has only recovered in real terms from the global financial crisis to early 2000s level. But more importantly, the median income, which better describes average standard of living, is very much lagging. By now, you've probably given up on getting a good trade idea from this call, but I'm mentioning inequalities here because their implication for markets are enormous. To put things quite simply, the consumer's pain and resulting inequalities has now turned into corporate pain. In 2016, the IMF estimated that the middle class shrunk from about 58% of total in 1970 to 47% in 2014, with an astonishing 75% moving down the income ladder. The study also shows that the rise in income polarization has decreased the level of real consumption at the aggregate level by a stunning 3.5%. This is basically more than a year of consumption. Beyond shrinking demographics, which we will all agree cannot easily be fixed, this is the real source of secular stagnation. Many look, for example, at the saving level, thinking it's back to healthy levels, but aggregate data hide the fact that almost half the population has negative savings. All this explains why I put an emphasis on aggregate demand leading growth, but also the Fed sinking, and this is nothing revolutionary. In the 20th century, Henry Ford had already sought to link product prices and employee wages, so the latter became a natural market for the former. The issue today is that Henry Ford's concerns have long been forgotten, and the one source of pent-up demand left, e.g. fixing inequalities, remains vastly ignored. Now, to go back to market, this explains why, beyond the initial hope factor, I do not see Trump being able to fix the US, especially this late cycle. His focus on repealing Obamacare and cutting taxes effectively is a further transfer from lower earners to cash-risk corporates. Even with the best intention and flush with cash, the lack of final demand means that corporates are unlikely to start investing and jumpstart an investment-led cycle. There is no prospect for more traditional aggregate demand growth ahead because the pent-up demand coming from employment growth is simply not there anymore, and wage gains have been a long time coming. That means that a more astute solution for Trump would be to fill the lowest earners' pockets.
Juliet, one of the first points that you make in the main piece, Red String of Fate Ties the U.S. to China, is you make the assertion that the FOMC outcome essentially validates and proves that your understanding of the Fed is correct. Now, I'm very fascinated by this because you definitely got the dollar and the Fed call spot on. So please explain this. Help us understand what your view of the Fed is and how it relates to your core belief about economic growth potential.
To answer your questions on how I consistently predict the Fed outcomes, and I'd like to stress that I have no direct line to Laker, the same way aggregate demand leads economic growth, it also leads Fed funds. And you can see that on page 3 and 4 of my report. It's less obvious this cycle due to the use of non-conventional tools to affect monetary policy, but the Fed has actually followed exactly the same script, and you can see that in some charts in my report. Now, I would compare the Fed's job to a sailing crew trying to stop a large sailing boat at a precise point. Any sailors amongst us will know that stopping on that precise point is probably as difficult, if not more, than traveling to this point. You have to take undercurrents into account, potential tailwinds, headwinds on the boat, even in absence of a sail, and et cetera. This is exactly the same for the Fed. Even with the Fed's mandate seemingly in reach, the FOMC has to take underlying macro forces into account, which are best described as aggregate demand growth. Well, demand growth is employment growth, which will soon converge to population growth for the at around 0.5%, because for the simple reason that we are at full employment, plus wage growth, which remains extremely subdued and a conundrum at this stage of the cycle. And this is a medium-term growth potential, grim prospects. So even with the economy at full employment, upcoming headwinds are strong enough that the Fed, despite an ambitious plan to get back to neutral, as to stay cautious or run the risk of canceling the budding virtuous circle. With no real macroeconomic improvement, there was and there still is no room for the Fed to turn more hawkish, especially given an already ambitious dot plot. Following Dudley's end of Feb interview and yesterday's minutes, I would also like to attract your attention on the Fed hiking because equities are too high. I think it's a very dangerous game, and I'll explain why. Firstly, at the high end of the income spectrum, a boost in equities may more than offset higher rates, but at the lower end, those with debt will likely only feel the pain of higher rates. The issue is they are the most likely to drive the economy going forward. Secondly, equities can turn on a dime, whilst monetary tightening can take months to feed through to lower demand. And thirdly, the stock leadership has changed only a few weeks after Trump's election, and cyclicals/value has consistently underperformed, leaving equities' stellar performance down to the equity risk premium compression. The risk is that if the Fed turns more hawkish with gloomy economic prospects, it flattens the curve and actually continues pumping up equities, not because of promising earnings prospect. In short, the Fed is reacting to worsening macro conditions by tightening. Ultimately, this is the perfect recipe for policy mistake. In short, the way I look at the Fed is by looking at what they have done in the past and what they should be doing, and I try to ignore the noise from Fed speak, and that's been really successful.
Now, in the next section, you move on to the business cycle and you pose the critical question of how long does Donald Trump have before it's too late? Please elaborate, because a lot of our guests have suggested that this business cycle is very long in the tooth. So how much longer can the euphoria last, and what are the charts on page 6 telling us?
In the section you describe, I've modeled aggregate demand, which is all monetary, by adding the two sources of money, basically incomes and the change in debt level. You can see on page 6 that this perfectly defines the business cycle and also the intermediate cycles. What should normally happen on the strong ISM boost is that income growth picks up on higher employment or wage gains, and credit demand should also pick up. This time, the opposite is happening, and this is telling me that the Trump trade is fantasy rather than the reality. The reality is that there is no such thing as a Trump trade in 2006, in 2016, there was no magic. The global economy reacted to the sharp easing in financial conditions stemming from the Fed's relent and China's vigorous stimulus, like it has always done. Because of very strong price-based effect, we had a bounce in activity. For example, energy sector capex collapsed 70% from 2014 to early 2016, and this subtracted 0.7% from real GDP. It's only natural that the bounce in prices necessarily caused the bounce in activity in 2016 from extremely low levels. The same goes for the distress level of inventory. The issue is that none of those effects can be extrapolated into 2017, and the effect of the global stimulus has largely run its course. In fact, base effects now work in reverse. In short, there is no such thing as a Trump trade, although it is somewhat discounted by both markets and the Fed. And I see this as a trading opportunity.
Juliet, the bulls would tell us that the ISM is at near all-time highs, and that signals nothing but rock-solid growth and economic strength on the horizon. Meanwhile, another popular narrative is that President Trump's tax and infrastructure spending initiatives will soon become reality. And these factors can only be bullish for asset markets, at least according to the bulls. You see it differently, so please explain why. Why don't we start with the graphs on pages 9 and 10 and what they're telling us, and explain also where China fits into this story.
So on pages 9 and 10, you can see that investment does not in any way corroborate the bounce in the ISM. And we started to see signs of a peak in ISM this week with both a weaker manufacturing ISM and a much softer non-manufacturing report. The leading indicators defined by new orders versus inventory sentiment also look to have already turned the corner. Basically, my fear is that the China-driven early 2016 stimulus caused a dead cat bounce in global activity. Trump's campaign promises greatly and artificially amplified the positive survey effect as herd instincts took over and created the illusion of a more sustainable cycle. I think we have already reached the top in terms of how far hope can support markets, and I'd recommend it from the Trump's night to pay rates anticipating hope to run wild. But reality is now about to hit. The longer China growth can hold steady and the longer it will take for financial conditions to tighten more meaningfully. But my best guess is that China growth can only be supported into the Congress this autumn.
In the fourth section, you assert that the Fed isn't really as dovish now as it may appear, but that it will likely be forced into more dovishness in the future. So please elaborate, and why don't we reference the charts starting on page 18 and maybe also talk about how this translates into trading strategies.
Okay, so this goes back to my earlier comments. As much as the Fed would like to think that the economy is in good shape and would like us to believe it, the tightening is happening despite breakevens being 40 basis points below levels consistent with achieving the inflation target. Income growth is showing no sign of life, and there is supposedly no assumption of a fiscal stimulus, yet the dots assume a return to neutral and a sustainable rise in the neutral real rate, which is currently assumed to be around 25 basis points. As soft data start converging to hard data, rather than the opposite, real yields will probably remain supported and risks stay offered. I'm not talking about an abrupt sell-off yet, but of a protracted top in risk. This means that dollar should stay offered versus yen and that I'd look for opportunities to buy euro again. This also means that U.S. equities should be sold on spikes and that fixed income will eventually unwind all the Trump trade in a flattening manner.
Juliet, I'd like to change the subject because although you are working in the City of London Financial Center, I think it's pretty obvious from your accent, our listeners have figured out that you're French. French election, holy cow, you know, this seems to be maybe after Brexit, the next big milestone in where the future of Europe could be headed. So as a French person, how do you see this? What do you think is likely to happen? What's at stake here?
On the French election, what I've been telling my clients is that I see quite a high potential for a last-minute twist, and I will tell you why. Firstly, you know, I haven't decided who I'm going to be voting for, which is historically quite weird. Secondly, I think a little less than 50% of the French population is still undecided, which historically, again, is weird, 2 weeks before the first run of the election. I was looking at a poll this morning asking, firstly, who do you think will win the election? And 49% thought Macron will win the election. But when the question was turned to who do you want to win the election, it was only 26%. So that really strikes me as like basically everybody is just like going for Macron because it's like, you know, in a way it's like the market's perfect candidate. He's young, he's liberal. The problem is there's quite a lot of lack of idea behind him, and he just seems to kind of agree with everyone. I don't feel this is the candidate that the French will want to vote for, will really want to vote for right now. So that's one thing, high level of uncertainty. And the second thing is that you've had basically the whole Socialist Party rallying behind Macron and basically leaving Hamon, who has been basically voted in as a Socialist candidate by French people, like basically polling now below 10%. Mostly because Mélenchon is doing much better with strong charisma and et cetera. But I think a last-minute twist could be for Hamon to basically rally into Mélenchon's campaign. And that could basically put Mélenchon in the second round and potentially even against Le Pen. So you'd end up with like a Mélenchon-Le Pen second round. Of course, that is still quite a low probability because it would call the death of the Socialist Party in France. But it's not really one that I would dismiss because it would make complete sense for Hamon to do this if it was just to make sure that the socialists that are still behind him can keep their seat in the election in June, in the parliamentary election in June. So I think there's still a lot of potential for last-minute twist. And I would absolutely not assume that it is going to be plain sailing.
Well, Juliette, I know that you have an extremely busy schedule supporting your institutional clients, so I'm not going to take too much more of your time. But before we close, most of the boutique advisories who operate the way you do, advising portfolio managers directly, work on a fixed system where everybody pays a very large annual fee of tens of thousands of dollars per year. But I think that you actually price your services tailored to the needs of each client. And it is even possible for very well-off retail investors, high net worth retail investors, to afford a version of your service. So please tell our listeners, what is the nature of the services that you offer? Who does it appeal to? And who should contact you with respect to the advisory services that you offer?
Basically, I've tried to democratize research offering by pricing per portfolio manager. So that means that the idea behind my service was to try and offer the service of strategies to macro startups. So from smaller funds to much bigger funds. And by pricing per portfolio manager, that means that by design, a smaller company will pay a lot less than a bigger one. I've got two different services. One includes basically all reports that I publish in a year, and that's about like 3 reports per month, which should be giving you really good roadmap to trade markets. And the second service is the premium service, which is pretty much closed, but I could have a couple new clients, and where I am basically available daily on all big data, big events with trade ideas and basically macro comments and macro thought. And this is the way JDR research is functioning.
Fantastic. Well, I do want to caution our retail audience that, you know, this is not a $99 a year service, so please don't waste Juliette's time. But for higher net worth individuals and certainly for institutions, I think that the way you've democratized things does put your research in reach to people that probably wouldn't be able to afford this style of research elsewhere. And I have to tell you, I'm just profoundly impressed with the work that you do and the reports that you sent us. So thank you so much for a fantastic interview, Patrick. Patrick Serezna, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
What a great interview with Juliet. I have to say that her comments on the French elections were very timely. It'll be very interesting to see whether or not there are some surprises. Certainly, it's something that the market is going to be anticipating or at least waiting to see over the next couple of weeks. What stood out for you in the interview?
Well, I think Juliet is absolutely brilliant, and it's a shame that, unfortunately, she had a lot of demands on her time from her clients, and we had to keep the interview fairly short this week. But I really strongly encourage our listeners to read that full 20-some-odd page sample research note, because her analysis is just brilliant, and she has been spot on in all of her market calls. I thought all of it was fascinating, and I definitely, I'd say, you know, don't let the French accent throw you off. Her thinking and her views are just extremely compelling in written form. So I strongly encourage everybody to read the full version.
All right, Eric, before we move on to our discussion of writing short option straddles and strangles, you mentioned during the market wrap that you received a listener question about the term structure of crude oil futures market. Our listener's question was about the prediction a lot of professional traders and institutional advisors, including Goldman Sachs, have made, which is that the structural backwardation will develop as a result of the market rebalancing. Now, this is a complex subject. How about giving our listeners a tutorial on what factors drive contango and backwardation in the crude oil market?
Well, sure, Patrick, but this is a fairly complex topic that definitely needs a picture. So we're going to have another download for you if you look in your research roundup email. It will say crude oil term structure chart, and that's what I'll refer to in this explanation. So if you look at that chart, what this is showing you is the prices of each consecutive delivery month for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures contract. So in other words, the leftmost dot that's down there around $51.75, that is what we call the front month contract, which is the one that expires on April 20th, and it's actually known as the May contract because it's for actual delivery of oil in the month of May, and the May contract settles in April. The next dot moving higher up would be the June contract and the July contract and so on and so forth. And the peak of where this keeps moving up and that price form where each subsequent month is more expensive than the previous one is called contango. And you see it goes all the way up to about the January or February of 2018 is the top of the mountain there. And then it starts to roll over back downhill where each subsequent price is lower than the previous one. That condition of lowering prices is known as backwardation. Now, the listener question that we got was about a lot of people's prediction that the term structure is going to move into a structural backwardation, essentially across the entire curve. So the whole thing, starting from the first dot, would just be downhill with backwardation moving along. And the reason people are predicting that is that what's driving the contango at the front end of the curve is the demand for storage. In other words, the way the people that own the storage tanks in Cushing, Oklahoma, and elsewhere make their money is by storing oil. They are long the physical commodity in a tank, and of course that tank costs them money, so they've got to make that money and also make a profit on top of it. The way they make that money back is they roll a futures position. They're long the physical, but they're short an equal number of futures contracts. And each month, they roll that short futures contract forward to the next contract. The contango indicates a demand for storage. In other words, there's money to be made by storing oil because they can make a profit by rolling the futures contract each month is higher than the one before it. So if you're short the front month, you're buying that front month and you're selling the next subsequent month at a higher price. And that difference in price is basically your revenue as a storage operator. You have to take out your cost of owning and insuring that physical tank. The rest is profit. That's how they make their money. So the only way that you can lose the contango in the front of the contract is if there's no need to store oil anymore. And we don't need to store oil. I think what the reason people are assuming that's going to be the case is they're expecting that sometime by the end of the year, we're going to get to a market rebalance condition, thanks to OPEC cutting its production, supposedly, that's going to eliminate the need for storage. Now, do they have the right idea? Basically, yes, I think that they do, because eventually we are going to see a rebalancing of the oil market, and that does indeed lead to structural backwardation. The thing is, the way the curve, the way the market is discounting things right now, they basically say that the backwardation starts right around the end of the year. 6 months ago, if you looked at this same chart, it had about the same shape, but the top of the hill there was around June. Well, the June contract now is the second dot here. You see a very steep contango there. I think that what's going to happen is people have got the right idea, but they're assuming that when supply and demand come into balance, and I think that's plausible for that to happen by the end of the year, although I don't think it's nearly as much of a certainty as a lot of analysts seem to think, that doesn't mean that we don't still have a lot of oil in storage. My contention, and this is definitely a view that a lot of people don't seem to agree with, is when the contango comes out of the front of the curve is when we don't need to store the oil anymore. And it's going to be a long time after the market rebalances before we slowly draw down all of that oil in storage and don't need to store it. So I think that although that backwardation is developing in 2018 and 2019, as we get closer to the end of the year, I think you'll see the front end of the curve still sloping down the way it is here. So the people who are betting that backwardation will develop in 2018 and 19, yeah, they've got the right bet. I wouldn't be surprised to see that steepen. But it's not going to last forever. If I wanted to make a bet, I wouldn't be looking at the December 18 to December of 19 spread trade, which is what our listener question was about. I would look at June 18 to June 19, figuring that you could put that trade on. Backwardation may very well develop there, and you'll still have time to profit from it before the front end of the curve rolls over into contango. Now, maybe by the time we get to June of 18, it won't be rolling over into contango. But I think that by the time we get to December of this year, that's, you know, a little more than 6 months away at this point, before that December contract is coming close to expiration, I think you're still going to have contango in the front of the curve at that point.
So now, Eric, you described why contango exists because of the storage of oil, but why is that backwardation there on that right side of the chart?
Well, the reason for the backwardation, I think, is that part of it has to do with people not expecting oil to need to be stored. But the real reason that those prices are being pushed down about 2 years out is that the shale producers have to hedge their forward production in order to get financing. So they're selling crude oil futures contracts about 2 years out. And there's not a lot of natural buyers for crude oil futures 2 years out. So what happens is the whole curve gets depressed, and the center of that depression is at the center of where the activity is in hedging shale oil forward production. As we see the market hitting what I think is kind of a topping process here. I don't think front month is going to go a whole lot higher than 55, as we've discussed in previous shows. I think a lot of producers are smart enough to recognize that and say, okay, we're hitting a high. It's time to put our hedges on. Where do they put their hedges on? About 2 years out. What does that do? It causes this depression in the middle of the curve about 2 years out, and that leads to backwardation, because the contango at the front end of the curve is coming from storage demand. That pushes those prices 4 to 6 months out up to that peak there that you see towards the end of 2017. And then the backwardation develops in 2018 because of downward pressure on crude oil futures dated in 2019. But in any case, I think we've probably beaten this subject to death. So, Patrick, for the last month or so, we've focused many of these post-game episodes on the topic of using option writing as an asset class. We've suggested that we would discuss the idea of short straddles and strangles. We already covered long straddles and strangles in a previous show. So please give our listeners a rundown on the strategy.
Well, first off, Eric, I have to say how disappointed I am by the content available on short straddles when you do a generic Google search on the internet. The internet is littered with retail level regurgitation of textbook theory on the risk reward outcomes at expiration. Without naming names, there are videos out there saying things like, you know, when you have this market outlook for the strategy, you want the stock to be completely flat and you want virtually no movement at all. I mean, no movement at all. They had to emphasize that. You know, and my response to that, try trading the strategy before putting up fake news quality videos on the internet, giving people a completely wrong perspective on the strategy.
Okay, hang on a second, Patrick. Let's slow down. We need to take a step back and understand the options combination. In other words, what is a short straddle or strangle before we can get into the nuances of the strategy? Now, several months back in episode 49, we discussed the long straddle strategy. So this time I would assume that we're doing basically the opposite. And at the time, the idea was, why would you consider a long straddle? Because it's a way to essentially buy volatility. So presumably what you're doing here is trying to sell volatility in an environment where there are ready buyers, but you think that the volatility risk is lower than the market is pricing it. Is that right?
So in that episode, we explored the idea of a long straddle, which was a simultaneous purchase of a call option and a put option. And we used the example of the SPY, which is the S&P 500 ETF, using an at-the-money April $227 call option and put option for a combined $9.50 cost. Now, since we recorded that episode, the S&P 500 exploded 100 plus S&P points higher, and the SPY ETF went all the way to $240 on the upside. But today, with the SPY trading near $235, the straddle is worth around $9 in value. In other words, we had this 100 plus S&P point rise, and the straddle is still struggling to become profitable.
Well, that's because the buyer had to pay double the premium in order to enter two option positions to form the straddle. And I used the analogy on that last show. It's like buying, you know, two non-refundable airline tickets to two different destinations and deciding after the fact which one you're going to actually travel on.
Exactly. So we can conclude that unless you anticipate a meaningful and immediate rise in volatility, or with the potential of a material move in the markets, the straddle is often a losing proposition. Now, if you in any way agree with that assessment, you would therefore have to conclude that being the seller of the straddle, the reciprocal counterparty, has a lot of room to profit in most market conditions.
So the strategy that you're suggesting is that someone sells the call and sells the put, knowing that one of those two legs has to be 100% profit because the market can't go both directions at the same time. And you're basically anticipating that there's not going to be such a big move that the other side of that has a larger loss than the profit that you made on the 100% side.
Right. So now in today's stock market environment, this is probably a bad time to consider this, as we have historically low volatility and the market is wound up with a potentially explosive move coming into the summer. But if, for instance, if you believe that oil or the US dollar or gold was going to be range bound, short straddling them for income is an interesting proposition. Now, back to my comments at the start of the post game, the strategy is a very valuable way to profit from the markets when you believe that there's going to be a contraction of volatility or some sort of a reversion trade where you're anticipating extended periods of consolidation in the market.
Well, first of all, Patrick, I want to echo your first point, which is that we're covering this strategy because it fits into our overall theme of covering different option writing strategies. But as far as the stock market is concerned, I don't think right now is the time to be writing disaster insurance, because I wouldn't be surprised if we had a disaster not too far out in the future in the market. Certainly on other assets, as you say, though, it might make sense. So how does this work from a portfolio perspective as opposed to to a trade perspective?
Well, I know several managers who complement a basket of long stocks with a short straddle. And this creates an interesting proposition because they create a situation where if the market is trading sideways, they are creating performance when the equities in their portfolio are doing nothing.
But doesn't that double the downside risk of a loss if there was some kind of black swan type of event to the downside?
Well, absolutely. If all you do is this combination, then yes. But many managers will use some of that big juicy premium that they're collecting at the money, and they're going to spend some of it to buy short-term, farther out of the money, tail risk hedges to remove the risk of a crash event. So this isn't a foolproof strategy. It does require a methodology that it does have a market timing element to add some strategic hedges to the short straddles. But the point I want to make, though, is that more often than not, the seller of straddles will find consistency in their returns.
You didn't mention strangles. Now, I assume it's basically the same strategy?
Yeah. Strangles is just separating the strike prices to create a wider maximum profit zone. It is the same principles. You just get less premium for giving you more forgiveness from short-term noise. I guess the key takeaway I want the listeners to think about is that when implementing short straddles and strangles, you shouldn't always think about the max profitability alone. You have a lot of forgiveness on the outer wings of the trade, and you have the ability to hedge that tail risk. The point is, don't stereotype the strategy without exploring it fully.
Well, unfortunately, Patrick, we are once again running out of time. So folks, if you want to learn all about this stuff, there's no better instructor and mentor than Patrick. So by all means, Patrick is in the business of teaching people about how to trade markets. Check out his website at bigpicturetrading.com to learn more about the online course offerings that he has. And by all means, keep your questions coming for topic requests as well as guest requests for this program via email at requests@macrovoices.com. And we do still need your help promoting the show, so please retweet us, tell your friends, use our new player embed, which allows you to put a Macro Voices player on any website in about 5 minutes' time. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our weekly research roundup email, which is a compendium of links to all the free cool stuff that we could find on the internet each week, including things like Juliet DeClercq's excellent research note sample, which was included in this week's research roundup. What else is in that research roundup this week, Patrick?
Well, you'll find in this week's email that there'll be the transcript for the interview with Juliet. In addition to that, you'll find that link to the chart you were referring to in terms of the oil term structure. You'll also find that link to Juliet's chart book to complement the interview. I also included a link to a CNBC article discussing the Congressional Budget Office warning about deficits going to explode over the next 30 years, and as well a link to a Bloomberg article on Japan inflation registering the first back-to-back rise since 2015. And why I find that very interesting is obviously they have that yield curve control that is being implemented by the Bank of Japan. So it'll be very interesting to see whether this is going to cause them to have to change their monetary policy. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.